This recording was made in The Booth, a ministry of Preston Hollow Presbyterian Church in Dallas, Texas. This is Mark Melson. I'm here with Julie Liston Johnson in The Booth to talk about a remarkable part of her life that she will probably never forget. Julie, before we get into that, though, let's tell people who you are and where you're from, where you were born and raised, and where you were educated, and what you do for a living.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me here today, Mark. I was born in the Midwest in Chicago and raised from the time I was six in St. Paul, Minnesota. Did my undergraduate degree in vocal performance there at the University of St. Thomas. After I graduated and an extra year there, I decided to move to New York City, as every good classical musician does, and try to take a stab at that. After a year, I did apply and was accepted to the Juilliard School for my master's.
One of the really great music schools in the country.
Absolutely. I had always wanted to go there, and this was just a thrill for me to be accepted and start my training there. So as I was there, I received two teaching fellowships, completed both of those during my master's, and then was subsequently hired on the adjunct faculty teaching sight reading in the evening division.
Wow, how many people get to do that right after graduating?
Well, not so many. I was very honored. And there was a mentor of mine I'm going to mention later who was very instrumental in making all of that happen, who is a dear friend of mine now. So I was in New York 12 years, met my now husband there. He is from Texas. So after we were married, we did move to Texas. And now I'm about to finish my doctorate in music at the University of North Texas.
Another really great music school in this
it
country.
It is. I've had great training, and I'm very blessed.
And your teacher, or one of your teachers, is a former Met opera singer.
Right. Is that right? And mm-hmm. She still is on, does some subbing and covering there. Oh, and okay. If time allows, we'll do roles there as well. So, good. Yes, she's a wonderful, wonderful teacher. Very blessed to have her. So I'll be finishing that. I'm working on my paper, about to start my paper this summer. So hopefully graduate in December with my DMA.
That's great.
Yeah.
And you are also a very fine soprano who, among other things, is singing in the choir at Preston Hollow Presbyterian Church.
Yes, I'm happy to be here. I've been here, I think, 5 years I've sung in the choir. Was lured over by Terry Price, who actually, when he was at Lover's Lane, my husband was his bass section leader. So that was the connection there. So I've been very happy to be here and in the choir.
Well, we're delighted. I can speak as a choir member. We're delighted that you're in the choir.
Thank you.
Today's interview will stay pretty focused on a remarkable time, not only in your life, but in the life of this country. And it's about a date and an event that is probably engraved forever in the hearts of anybody who's over 25. Mm-hmm. In this country, one of those, where were you when such and such happened? And what we're talking about was the destruction of the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. And you were there.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you doing in New York City on November 11, 2001? And how did that day begin?
Well, as I mentioned, I had graduated with my master's in 98. And had been singing in New York and did a lot of temp work, which a lot of musicians and artists do, so working for different big companies.
You didn't have to wait on tables like
some of
them.
I chose not to do that. Okay. So I did a lot of executive administrative work. And I had temped a lot for American Express Corporate Company, which is in the World Financial Center right downtown. So they...
No, excuse me. The World Financial Center, is that part of the World Trade Center?
It's right across the street.
Ah.
It's not really connected, but there are three major buildings right across the street from where the World Trade Center was, and I was in the tallest of those. So 50th floor of 51. One of the department I worked in was data privacy and data protection, And they decided to hire me a part-time permanent job, so 3 days a week. So I had been hired at this point at the Juilliard Evening Division faculty, taught my first class September 10th and of 2001. So I had worked, I think, only 1 week for American Express as an actual permanent employee. So that morning, I was getting ready for work just like any other day. I lived in northern Manhattan up at about 218th Street and Broadway. Yeah, about an hour subway ride on the A train down to the World Trade Center. So, so that day, so I came down, starting to tell my story now. I came down on the A train, and the station I got off in was Chambers Street, which is located pretty much right under the World Trade Center. There were a lot of shops down there, kind of a mall, food places, and I remember looking at my watch and thinking, okay, it was, I think, 9:52, and so I went hurrying off to try to get to my job on time. As I was going past, going down a certain corridor just to go under the World Trade Center, there were lots of people running the other way. And I thought, oh, these tourists, what are they doing? And so, but as I quickly learned that we were all being directed to go up the stairs and go outside of the subway. So I walked up the stairs and immediately, I must have been on about the northeast corner of the World Trade Center property and looked up and could see flames shooting out of the building. And, you know, it was, of course, it was very high up there. And while it sounds strange now, as a New Yorker, you see a lot of weird things. Things happen and you still have to get to work. So immediately I thought, how do I get to work? So I turned and I went to Broadway and thought, well, let me walk down Broadway a little bit and kind of walk my way around. Meanwhile, everybody's on their cell phones trying to make calls. You know, calls went down very quickly. I managed to get one through to my boss and said, I don't know what's going on, but I'm going to be late. So as I took my way down Broadway, there was another what I thought was explosion. I thought what was burning blew up again. People started screaming, running. And what I learned later is this is when the second plane hit the South Tower. So I thought, I've got to get out of this crowd and figure out what I want to do. So I thought, well, let me go to Trinity Church. Trinity Church, I had been singing there in the professional choir about 3 years.
Episcopal?
Yes, Episcopal mm-hmm. Church. And they are right smack dab, a couple blocks from the World Trade Center. And I thought, well, let me go there. So I went in there, and that's where I first learned that it was planes that hit the buildings. I had no idea before that. I also heard eventually that the Pentagon had gotten hit. So cell phones weren't working at this point, so I decided there was a landline at the church, and I made two calls, one to my next-door neighbor, who was my best friend, and another one to my parents in Minnesota. My dad answered. I just never forget because in his voice, he just said, well, you're nowhere near there, are you? Because, of course, they had been watching the news and saw what was going on.
How did you respond to that?
Well, of course, Dad, yes. Yes, this is that's where I work, didn't you know? And so I said, I'm fine. I'm at Trinity Church. All is well. So as I was there, of course, there were a number of people in the church. I think about between 20 and 30 people at the church.
It's not a huge church, as I recall.
Well, you know, it's not small either,
right.
You know, but it's not a massive cathedral.
Not a cathedral.
No.
Right.
But there, you know, I don't know that a lot of people were thinking to go in the church. There were people that came in to pray, but about 20 to 30 people. I remember one woman, I think she was the wife of a staff member who was really hysterical. And I remember having the thought, you know, that's not helping anything. You know, we've got to figure out what we need to do. And I mentioned calling my next door neighbor. And I thought I was very calm when I called her. Later, she played me that message, and I wasn't so calm. So anyway, I got the phone calls through, decided to wait there. The director of music, Dr. Owen Burdick, was also there. So, you know, we kind of waited it out, listened to the radio. And the most terrifying moment, I think, had to be when we heard the bending of the metal of the building coming down, because we never dreamed it would come down. Someone screamed, "Oh my God, it's coming down." Well, not knowing how a building's constructed and how it's going to fall, we assumed it was going to fall flat over, like it'd been chopped at the bottom and would just fall. So we, huge group of us, went running down to the basement where there was a very large boiler room. And I even remember there was sort of like a dirt floor down there. We used to sometimes walk through there to get out the gate after hours. Well, as we got down there, it was already filling with this dust, and we realized we can't be down and be buried. And we very quickly realized, or at least I did, that there really was nowhere safe to go with a building that huge. You just didn't know, you know, what was going to happen. So we ran back up to the top. The church obviously was not smashed. And the church was itself filling with smoke at this point. So we...
And how far was the church from the South Tower?
I would say... I mean, less than a mile. It's probably, I mean,
I remember it as just a couple of blocks.
It's, yeah. Yes, really a couple of blocks. They're long blocks.
Yeah, right.
But like I said, that room we ran to was actually facing the same direction as the towers. So as we were up in the church, filled with dust, we actually took altar cloths out of the drawers and wet them so that we would have something to breathe through that would be a little more clear. So we waited until the second tower came down. We waited a little longer for the dust to settle and figured it was time to go and try to find our way home. So we walked outside. I was with Owen Burdick, the director of music, and we decided to walk up the East Highway because, well, I guess we didn't even make that decision. The police made it for us. Mm-hmm. We were directed in that way. But as we walked...
Which is farther away from the World Trade Center site.
It is. We had to go far east and around before we could start
going. Because the World Trade Center was sort of near the Hudson on the west
side.
Right.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So walking out, I'll never forget, because I hadn't been looking out any windows. You know, I was in the church with stained glass windows. But to walk out and see everything so gray and so covered with dust, there were... high heels sitting on the street. There were baby strollers. There was about, I'd say, 4 inches deep of dust just everywhere.
And were there still people running around the streets? Was there any traffic?
Didn't see traffic at this point.
Emergency vehicles,
a lot of people, a lot of sirens going off. And there was a whistle that we didn't know what it was that just kind of, I can only describe it by making the noise, but this kind of whistle that we later learned that's firemen have it equipped on their uniform that after they've been still for too long, that siren goes off so that the other firefighters can find them. So there were a lot of those going off.
Oh, dear.
Which is very sad. So Owen and I, hand in hand, took off for the East Highway, East Side Highway, to walk up north to Grand Central. Nothing was running. You couldn't get on the subway. There were no cabs to be had. Tons of other people, hundreds of other people. We walked all together.
I don't know why I'm thinking of this now, but what kind of shoes were you wearing at the time? Were you dressed nicely for work, or did you have something comfortable?
Yes. Well, I had dressed that day in my favorite brand new light blue linen dress, and I was so proud. And I had grabbed these little, they weren't high heels, but little wedge shoes. Mm-hmm. And at the very last minute, as I left my apartment, I grabbed my tennis shoes like a good New York businesswoman. Mm-hmm. And I was very glad I did. Even in the tennis shoes, I managed to throw out my back and have some pain, but you know, that's nothing to complain about for that day. So I had my tennis shoes. We started walking north with everybody else, constantly turning to see the smoke, to see just what else was going to happen. You know, we didn't know even as we were walking if we could be hit again. So it was a very terrifying time. We walked us about 4.5 miles up to Grand Central.
4.5 miles on pavement.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just walking north. And I've heard of people walking even further than that. So I was, the idea of just getting to about the middle of the island and getting to Grand Central was good. That's where Owen and I parted ways. He went to check on a friend of his who was at Columbia University. And I got on a train, and as I walked in Grand Central, they weren't giving people tickets. They were just ushering us, get on the trains, get on the trains. So I found a train going north. It wasn't a route that I usually took. I don't even remember the stop I got off at, but I somehow figured out where I should get off, got on a bus going west, made it home about 4:30. As I got off out of the train station to get on the bus is when I first noticed that people were staring at me.
Because you were coated with dust?
Mainly from the bottom, yes. I had some, like, you know, a little around the armpits, and then, but the bottom, about third of my dress was covered in the dust. So it
was... Which, even that far north, there was still dust?
No, I mean, that's why I looked, I looked so out of place. Because it was obvious to everybody who knew what was going on. They could see that I had been down there. So yeah, about 4:30, I got home. Was reunited with my neighbor, who also had worked at Trinity Church in the music office. So she had tried to go down with her daughter, who my goddaughter, who's 3 months old, was 3 months old at the time. So they didn't make it all the way down there before they were evacuated, and she turned back around, thank goodness, because, you know, it's hard enough to walk by yourself, but to be carrying a three-month-old is not what you want to be doing in this time either. Mm. But she had been making plans even, you know, we had these emergency plans, you know, let's fill the bathtubs with water in case the water supply goes bad. They had two cars, she and her husband, so, you know, you don't usually have cars in New York. She said, well, let's, you know, we could pack up. You could drive one car. We'll go to my grandparents in Virginia. You know, we still were filled with this fear. So at this point is when she played this message that I left. And I really, you know, just saying, I don't know what's going on down here. Please don't come down with the baby. And like I said, I thought I was calm.
Yeah, yeah.
I was not calm.
Yeah.
So...
When did you get back in touch with your parents to let them know?
Yes, and that's why I mentioned that I did talk to them. I think it was probably 6:37 that night that they were able to get through. And the interesting thing, I had another dear friend who worked with me in American Express who had tried to go down, got home much earlier than I did that day, and he was calling around checking on his friends. And when he couldn't find me, he called my parents in Minnesota. So at that point... also, because I had told my dad where I was, that I was at Trinity Church, so my brother, who had called them checking on me as well, Googled or MapQuested and saw Trinity Church World Financial Center. They're just right next to each other.
Right.
So, you know, I remember my brother being very upset, and when my friend Michael had called, he said, well, why doesn't he go down and get her? You know, which really is not a possibility. They weren't letting people back down there at that point. So, yeah, about 6 o'clock that night, so that they knew I was okay. And life changed quite a bit after that. You know, pretty much listened to CNN 24 hours a day, wondering what was going to happen next. We heard, it was a deafening sound to hear the fighter jets going above.
Fighter jets.
I'm guessing
that's... That were scrambled, probably.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't even know what... What is it, a B-52? I don't know what. I'm not good with
a bomber, but that's close. It's still a big, noisy airplane.
Right, very noisy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, because I was there a few years after the fact, didn't Trinity Church play a big role in assisting the first responders who would come there to rest and to get fuel and water? And
absolutely. Yeah. There's St. Paul's Chapel that's owned by Trinity Church is a few blocks north of Trinity Church and directly behind the World Trade Center site. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think what they found so amazing is with all the destruction, all the buildings that did fall down, I think St. Paul's Chapel had one cracked window. So it's really amazing. But that became a base for the workers to get food, massages, drinks, you know, and some relief. And my now husband did quite a bit of volunteering there and helping. So, yeah, that's St. Paul's Chapel, very close. Mm. Trinity Church, we weren't able to get into for quite a while. But in a few weeks, we were able to hold services at another church, Mary Elizabeth Seton, which was a Catholic church just down a little further. So we did Sunday afternoons when they weren't in service and held services there. And it was very eerie to go back into ground zero, especially those first weeks when it was so devastating. So we held services there. And the other really interesting thing that we did, Trinity had a tradition of doing the Messiah every year. And partly because the premiere in the New World of the Messiah was at Trinity Church.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. The original premiere was in Ireland,
right,
I believe.
Right.
But the New World premiere was at Trinity Church. So every year we did the Messiah. And that year they decided, no, they couldn't afford to do it, or we weren't going to do the Messiah. Well, the radio station, WRR,
WQXR,
yes. Sorry, I've been in Dallas too long, got word of that and decided to pay for it.
Wow.
So they sponsored and also did a live broadcast of our performance. So I have a recording of that at home with me singing a few solos and Bert and singing some solos. So really wonderful that they would sponsor us in that way and continue that tradition.
There's a story about the organ at Trinity,
mm-hmm.
and tell us what happened to that instrument.
Yeah, it turned out to be a wonderful story. The Aeolian Skinner organ, it wasn't the original organ to the church, but this particular one had been there 80 years. With, of course, the church being so close and being filled with dust, the pipes, the organ itself, was just also covered in all of this dust. So they decided it would be too difficult to clean it and to repair it. Dr. Owen Burdick already felt like the organ had some problems, so they did remove the organ and went to a different process. But the organ had been in storage for a long time. Well, a neat connection that Bert and I had, a friend of ours who did get his doctorate at UNT as well. That's how we knew him. But it was the new music director at Johns Creek United Methodist Church outside of Atlanta.
I know that church.
Do you? Yeah. And they just built a new sanctuary a couple years previous to that.
Their organ associate, their associate organist right now, is a former director of music here.
Oh, really?
Ken Axelson,
okay.
Who's retired, but he still goes there and he fills in on the organ. And I remember him telling about how this historic instrument was moved to their church.
Yeah, they were looking after they had done this huge renovation or the building of the new church. They didn't feel they had the money to buy the kind of size organ they wanted, and they were looking into some used instruments, what possibilities. And that's where they learned about the Trinity organ that had been in storage for so long. I think it still cost somewhere in the about $1 million to refurbish it, and I think even more to have it installed and doing all the voicing and everything that they do. So when they had decided to do this, Nathan Franks contacted Bert, knowing that Bert's my husband. Bert mm-hmm. and I had met at Trinity Church in the choir, both singing in the choir. What he didn't know is my story of going through 9/11 and being there as well at Trinity. So he flew us out, and we were very instrumental in the beginning of their campaign for fundraising to restore the Trinity organ. It's been, I think they did the installation service last December. So it's very new, but they're very glad to have it. An interesting story, Nathan had called me and said, "Do you know what the last hymn was that was played on the Trinity organ?" So I contacted Owen, and he told me it was "O God, Our Help in Ages Past." And he said, "I don't even need to remind you that it has the words, our help, from the stormy blast.
Our shelter. From the stormy blast."
From the stormy
which
blast.
Which Trinity Church indeed was on 9/11.
Exactly.
Wow.
So we're, you know, it's just a wonderful thing that the Trinity organ lives on
mm-hmm.
Now outside of Atlanta. And is loved, and I think I just heard an interview that they were saying they call it their instrument of peace,
mm-hmm.
and that can live on. So really, really wonderful. And you know, there was another wonderful thing that happened to me
mm-hmm.
throughout this. Of course, you know, I was laid off from mm-hmm. my job at American Express, which I expected to happen. Lots of people were being laid off. And temporary work had really dried up. So
sure.
I thought, well, what am I going to do? I'm not making my living as a singer yet. the adjunct at Juilliard was wonderful, but it was only one day a week. So it's really not enough to pay your rent. So I decided to move home to Minnesota. And my mentor, Mary Anthony Cox, who was my ear training teacher at Juilliard, got word of that. So she called me and she said, "Look," she says, "it's not the time for you to leave New York. You've just been hired at Juilliard. You've got great things ahead of you." She said, I want to offer you a spot, a room in my apartment.
Wow.
She said, I don't want rent. I have the space and I want to help you. And, you know, I think she's from somewhere in the deep South, either Mississippi or Alabama. And I remember, you know, me being so overwhelmed and saying, I can't believe you would do this for me and just let me move into your home. And she said, honey, if we're not put on this earth to help each other out, what are we here for?
Powerful story. Yeah. Wow. You know, when you made that 4.5 mile walk right after the destruction of the World Trade Center, did you see acts of kindness, acts of people coming together and being helpful?
Yes. I mean, that day, certainly, there were bodegas giving out bottles of water and things like that. But even more so, not even just that day, but the weeks and months that followed, there was just a kindness and people really looking out for each other that we hadn't necessarily experienced before. Even just personally, I remember, kind of silly, but my neighbor and I drinking out of our best china teacups.
Wow.
You know, just saying, life is precious. We need to enjoy it. But yes, I mean, all of the volunteers. A friend of mine who was at Columbia University Medical School, when they first heard of this all happening, they got ready. They were, you know, they were still medical students, but they were ready to try to help. And the saddest thing I remember her saying at that point is the ambulances just weren't coming with people. So it was more about, you know, people being gone than really as many people to help. Of course, I mean, there were so many wonderful responders that, you know, tirelessly were digging for people and found people even days after this happened. One of the most gruesome things that I think I heard about this story is, you know, I mentioned that I had worked at American Express in the tallest building. Mm-hmm. My office that I worked on was the 50th floor of 51. Later, my boss told me, because they had a view directly to the World Trade Center, and they saw people in the building after this just happened actually making the decision, grabbing hands and jumping.
Wow.
And that, you know, I don't tell that.
There was no way down for them at that point.
No, you know, and you have to think, you know, this building is so tall and so huge. The heat from that burning had to be so horrible for them to make that kind of a decision that it's done and we need some relief.
Julie, how did this whole experience, looking back now, how did this whole experience change your life?
Wow. Well, you know, I think immediately after, it was the shock that we weren't immune from destruction and terrible things happening. I think, you know, the woman that I lived with then, this professor, she had lived in Paris. She studied at the Paris Conservatory and had seen war, had seen, you know, horrible things happen. And what she said to me, your generation has never lived through anything like this. And I think so initially, it was just the feeling that anything can happen and that fear. But then I think overwhelmingly positive from that is how people do come together and how you do need to live your life to the fullest and make choices not based on material things, but what you want in your life, what makes you happy, and how you can help other people achieve their goals as well.
It's interesting that this horrific event, which was precipitated by some of the worst of humanity, was redeemed in part by some of the greatest examples of the positive side of human beings.
Absolutely.
Fascinating story. Are you going to tell this to, I know you have a daughter, have you had a chance to tell this to your daughter and explain it, or are you waiting for that?
It's interesting because I was talking yesterday at lunch with my husband's staff, the people that he works with, and she was right there, and we were talking about this interview happening, and so I turned to her because she hasn't really heard about this. I said, "Have you heard about this event yet at school?"
How old is she?
She's 8.5, so going into third grade. She said, "No, I don't know what you're talking about." And so we just kind of said, you will. You're going to hear about it. And the pastor there said, and your mommy's going to have some stories to tell you. But I don't think she's ready quite yet. It's, you know, even talking here to you, and every time I tell it, the emotions come back up.
Sure, sure. Well, we're grateful that you took the time and the trouble to relive that and tell us all about it from the vantage point of somebody who was right there. Mm-hmm. Julie, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This recording was made in The Booth, a ministry of Preston Hollow Presbyterian Church in Dallas, Texas. For more information about The Booth, visit www.phpc.org.